we're at an inflection point when it comes to design. And I think, you know, you need to get ahead of that, right? Not to discard traditional tools by any means, right? You still got to sketch, you still got to know CAD, right? But these are new ways to open up your aperture to bring some fresh thinking to the table.
With a career spanning the intersection of cutting-edge consumer electronics and groundbreaking healthcare innovation, our guest today, Oisin Omorhothuk, brings a wealth of experience and vision to the table. From his past experience at industry giants like LG and Philips to his most recent role as the Director of Industrial Design at Aruladen, Sheen has left an undeniable mark on the world of design, pushing boundaries and redefining possibilities at every turn. But what truly sets Oisin apart is his curiosity and passion for exploration, a trait that led him to embark on a personal journey of creative discovery with his project, Improbable Futures. What began as a simple tool for creative enjoyment and experimentation has since evolved into one of the foremost Instagram accounts of AI-generated concepts, showcasing the incredible potential of artificial intelligence as a catalyst for innovation and inspiration. So sit back, relax, and prepare to be inspired as we embark on a journey into the limitless possibilities of design with Oisin.
Oisin, it's so great to have you today. You are an accomplished industrial designer. You've worked with everybody from LG Electronics to Philips Design. You have both corporate and agency experience. You were among the first to share what the crossroads of AI art and industrial design concept sketching could look like. Take us back a little bit and tell us about the start of your career and how that evolved through different geographies, different departments, and more about how that led to what you're doing today.
Let me see. I wrote it back. So, well, I have a degree in industrial design, studying in Ireland. It was always a dream to kind of study ID, which I'll kind of touch upon later. But like, I mean, I think I grew up in the heyday of consumer electronics. So I just wanted to kind of be in that space, design Walkmans, design cell phones. So ID, when I first heard about it, was like, yeah, that's kind of where I want to be. So spent 4 years there and then spent another year afterwards, moved into interaction design, right? It was at that cusp when web design was getting a little bit more serious. Interface design was kind of thing. So it's kind of interesting in that as well, right? Hardware I knew was only an avenue for something, but you know, I was interested in the other aspect as well. So I took another year out and got a master's in multimedia systems, it was known, but it was more of a general kind of look at digital tools as well. And then my first job after that was actually in architecture. So spent about 2 years for an architectural firm in Dublin, leaned heavily into 3D modeling, which is actually funny. My dad was a model maker, architectural model maker when I was growing up. So I was always interested in that. So that was kind of my field for about 2 years doing digital models in that space. And then, you know, kind of wanted to get back into industrial design and found a job in Italy, moved there with LG Electronics. And that honestly was my dream job. So I designed cell phones, TVs, white goods, soft goods, everything. It was just super cool. I think, you know, pre-iPhone, so designing cell phones then was a little bit more interesting, right? You have Nokia, their heyday. Siemens were doing some nice stuff. Philips were on the market. I forgot who else was there. Samsung. It was just so much fun, right? You could do the hell you wanted. So we spent about 2 years in Italy just designing crazy stuff, slider phones, twisting phones, rotating phones, just, you know, that next killer form factor. And then the iPhone came out and it kind of ruined everything. but then I spent, well, not ruined everything. It was just like, that's
changed the focus, right? It was less about concept and theme and, you know, capturing the attention and driving experience through kind of the hardware design, right? Which then opened up avenues for new interaction software. And then it was chasing millimeters and, you know, Squircle Radii, and but then you have like Samsung and LG probably pumping out tons and tons of concepts still, and Apple just doing little iterations, right?
Yeah. I mean, at the time, our focus from the marketing team was like, what's that killer app, right? So they're looking at it from a, you know, this phone's got text messaging, it's got a phone with megapixels, it's got MP3. So you'd like Sony at the time, they're kind of introducing, here's our Walkman phone, here's our Cybershot phone. They're kind of looking at a very kind of segmented approach. And then Apple kind of waltzed in and just said, this does everything and does it really, really well. You know, that touchscreen is like, oh my God. Yeah, I mean, what they presented wasn't anything shocking. You know, everyone had sketched that form factor. Everyone talked about touchscreens, but they absolutely nailed it to the point where you're like, oh my God, this is it. That's the archetypical phone. That's the new benchmark. Everything will be measured before this phone and after as well. Yeah. I think that still stands.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, for me then, we were in the lab for 2 years, super fun, lots of great design work floating about. And then we kind of moved that studio to London. So it was kind of fun. A few of us moved to London and we had a blank. We were able to kind of the studio up again. It was kind of fun. We were shopping around, got to choose a location in Covent Garden and actually design the studio in the ground up, bring the architects in and sort of say, hey, what's your perfect design studio? And that is actually really difficult to do. Easy to say, but we need to get down to the brass tacks. Well, actually, how much space do you need for tables? How much space do you need for you know, the studio itself for sketching, for materials? So there's just a lot of moving parts, and we had an absolutely sweet space. I'll be honest, I've never worked in a studio as nice. It was obscene. And it was kind of partly that we had it was kind of viewed as more of a flagship studio, for LG to flex a little bit in Europe. But it was fun. So there kind of, I focused a little bit more than, you know, whereas Milan was more future-facing, more concept work, Blue Sky, never really going to be made, more provocations. When we moved to London, the shift then became going to manufacturing, getting a little bit more serious and getting the weeds of it as well. And again, that was kind of across TVs, it was across washing machines. Yeah, it was quite diverse, a very, very exciting time to be in design. And then, yeah, I just got tired of it, right? I think 4 years in London would have been around 2010. I think consumer products started to get really boring then. Certainly, you know, TVs, you're not really designing much. You know, people had solved that. Cell phones, as I mentioned, not really much is happening. Everyone's trying to copy what Apple's doing, and there wasn't that much investment in the products, right? So I got a little bit tired with consumer electronics and just wanted to change the scenery. I remember walking across Waterloo Bridge in London, and it was just lashing rain. I'm like, fuck this place. I don't live here anymore. So I need to go somewhere sunny. So of course I thought I'll move to the US.
We'd like to take a moment to remind you that Play In Conversations is brought to you by Play & Co. If you want to explore more about design opportunities, discover new insights, or connect with Play & Co for a design project, be sure to visit playandco.com.
Question, when you made that move from, or I guess maybe chose to stay with LG when they made that move to London, did you know it was going to be moving out of kind of like the vision, you know, kind of innovation projects to more of the, I guess, like inline and production type of stuff? Was that like a conscious thing? You're like, yeah, I'm sticking through this, or did that kind of develop after you got there?
A bit of both. I pushed for it, right? So the space I wanted to be in. I wanted to get more serious with it. So it wasn't just a complete swap. It was more a shifting of percentages. So I think just more of a serious focus on, you know, that phase of my career.
Getting stuff made. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. It's like nice to have a bit more fun with conceptual work, but you're going to want to actually touch and feel this, see that in the market. See how other people interact with it. And yeah, it just became more of a kind of a aspirational goal then.
Can I ask a question off the back of that? I wrote it down. What do you think just from your experience in Italy and Milan, you know, you mentioned the word provocations. What do you reckon the role, do you think that provocations, there's a role for that in design these days, or what is the role for that in design these days? Like, if you think about companies, because to your point about Apple, right, they come along and wipe out Nokia overnight, kind of metaphorically, with a touchscreen, with the answer. And that's kind of a disruptor mentality. But do you know, is it, I guess what I'm trying to say is the role of provocative design, you know, forward-thinking, vision-focused design, how much can that help companies envision, for lack of a better term, envision the future, you know, to get ahead of the market, to maybe create more innovative products, services, whatever, UI, I guess. I don't know if this question's going anywhere, but I wanted to hit on the whole provocation thing. Like, where do you come down on them today and how they fit design?
You need a balance, right? Provocation for provocation's sake is kind of pointless. Then you get to, you know, vaporware territory, just concepts. And if you don't deliver on that, people just get tired of it. But I do think you need to, you know, the very heart of good design, it's about provoking, it's provocation. But it does need to exist, right? Yeah, so you're going to have to wear both hats. I mean, you can, you know, show some of the vision work, but if you don't deliver on that, then it's like, oh, just you're kind of selling a dream that, you know, people just don't buy into any further. And that was kind of the kind of challenge of Philips in many ways. They were kind of known for their vision probes and they kind of backed away from that, which I think kind of personally is a little bit of a misstep. You know, certainly for me, that's what put a spotlight for me on Philips, seeing their work in Milan, seeing it at the furniture fair, their vision of the future. It was just super bold and provocative. And I still think it, you know, even today, it still stands the test of time. And maybe they just got it right where they hit that middle ground of saying, we know this isn't about making it. It's never going to be made, but we're going to go far enough that you can really believe in it, see it, touch and feel it in some way beyond just a rendering or here's just a vision in a video maybe. But I do think that's, you know, it's design, you know?
Yeah, we had Stefano on the podcast and he was talking about one of those programs in the 90s, the future, Vision of the Future, I think it was called actually. And I think it was one of the first programs that I remember seeing, and I'm sure it might not have been the first, but it was one of the big ones where they actually produced videos and experiential mock-ups and storytelling to sort of say, this is the technology that's coming down the pike. And I think what was great about the Vision of the Future was they had, if you wind back the clock and you go back to that time, you're like, they predicted tablets, smartphones, and the smart kitchens, smart devices, all of this stuff in the 90s, you know, a decade or two before it really became mainstream. So to that end, I think they were on the mark. And then it becomes a question of how much a company can leverage that or designers can leverage that.
Totally. And you mentioned, Oshin, around 2010, you saw a trend in consumer products. Around that time, you came over to the East Coast U.S. From Europe. How did the journey evolve from there? And around that time, were you also seeing different trends in geography, different trends, you know, coming about in the 2010s? What was that like?
I'm trying to just laughing at the different trends in geography, that there is, you know, a difference between European designers, American designers, and, you know, working for a Korean company had a different sort of design sensibility as well. So yeah, that was a little bit of an eye opener when I first moved here. In a good way, but like, yeah, I still think the American design, I can't put my finger on it, but there's a certain attitude, I think. Whereas maybe in Europe, there's a bit more of a restraint. I think when American design it's just a little bit bigger and bolder as well. Gosh, that sounds so cliche. But I, you know, seeing that was something that was so important to be exposed to that as well, right? There's a danger. You kind of end up in this echo chamber of, you know, here's this design sensibility and this is where we're going to move towards. And I think just getting that different point of view, a different challenging point of view, right? Someone, remember actually going to this design meetup and having a conversation about it, and someone was getting into an argument with me about it. I'm like, oh, okay, this is, you know, you're quite passionate about this. Like, whereas I think I would have been kind of used to surrounding myself with other designers who like, that would say, yes, European minimalism is the better way to kind of be with the, some of the directions as well. That's and then that coupled with, you know, I moved, as like I said, out of consumer electronics into healthcare, which is just an absolute shock in many ways. And, you know, I knew what I was getting into, and that was part of the appeal to see if I could introduce some of that design sensibility into this kind of raw space that desperately needed it. You know, Philips sleep portfolio, I'm like, this is dreadful work. And but at the same time, I saw it as an opportunity. But I didn't realize, or, you know, I really didn't comprehend how much of a challenge that would be, how much of a journey that would take me on for about 10 years. So I honestly thought that people would be open and receptive to good design, and that's just not the case at all. That was just a battle each time. I mean, you guys know this. It's just
The audience doesn't, so it might be good for you just to frame up a little bit what your role, like what that 10 years in healthcare looked like, jumping into the sleep health space for Philips. Maybe can you just sort of talk to what your role evolved into, and then elaborate a little bit on what you saw and what you tried to inject from a design sensibility perspective, because I think that's a big topic these days, right? And particularly given the amplifying costs of healthcare and people wanting to kind of find other options than spending a fortune on private cover and, you know, preventative healthcare. So it's a hot topic, and it definitely needs a lot of design sensitivity.
Yeah, I'll try and summarize this. Well, I joined the Philips sleep and respiratory division. And my focus was on designing, when I first joined, their next generation CPAP, right? Which is this box that sits beside your nightstand and blows air down your throat. To help address sleep apnea. And when I first joined, I was like, I have no idea what sleep apnea was, kind of thrown in the deep end. I didn't know what I was doing. But they kind of gave me this black slate and said, you can redesign this from the ground. Here's a team, here's an opportunity to take this to a different direction. I think, and that was super exciting to have a company, I have a team that was open to that, because it desperately needed it. These products just don't have the love and care that's needed for people to use these products over a lifetime, right? These products, you're not, you know, using them in certain moments. If you're on sleep apnea, or if you've got sleep apnea, it's something you need to deal with for the rest of your life. So that longer term motivation, I really kind of felt strongly that design had to play a fundamental role in that, to get people to use this every night, to fall in love with this, to stay with people on this journey as well. This new product, and it was an absolute headache. It was pulling teeth left, right, and center, because I think the other thing is that I was quite used to a certain sensibility when it came to design, that just again wasn't present in the company and the culture that I was joining as well. Not to diss them at all, but just didn't have that muscle that I was kind of used to when it came to LG, that, you know, they are a consumer-focused company. So the details really made a difference here. Whereas with healthcare, and this is the education for me, design maybe wasn't the most important thing. And the engineering aspect, there's so many other factors that fed into it as well. So it was such a wonderful way to kind of understand maybe the bigger picture, right? And that sort of set me on a journey to get a little bit bigger and broader and get more wider on where I wanted to kind of influence from a design perspective, right? So I joined that company with a hardcore focus on hardware. And then I slowly kind of moved into, you know, broader view of experiences as well, right? So, you know, these products don't sit in isolation. They work within this bigger machine. And I think for them to work effectively, you need to know how the machine operates. And, you know, maybe there's ways to, I'm not going to say change the machine, but just to be conscious of what that is and where the kind of cogs are and where you can kind of, you know, maybe put some oil on them in certain moments so that things can go a little bit smoother as well. So after designing that device, I kind of shifted focus then to the broader parts of the system. You got a mask, you got tubing, you got the interface, you have the apps, you have the service, packaging, the full thing, right? And it was something that I was super happy to see a bigger viewpoint on. And I think that's where, you know, we started to kind of meet. Where for me then, you know, to pull off more ambitious goals, I needed to partner with some more ambitious teams and people as well. And I, you know, super happy that we kind of connected. And it's something, you know, Martin, we spoke about, and that's what resonated with me when we kind of connected. Like, the vision was something super bold, super provocative, but it needed to exist. And with that, we were going to take on some very, very, very difficult challenges. But it could be done. And I think you guys got that immediately. But also conscious of the fact that this wasn't going to happen overnight and it would take a long time to put the parts in place as well. Yeah. And that's the challenge with healthcare, right? It's compared to consumer products where you're this fast follower, moving quick, you're getting stuff out and then turning it around very rapidly. With healthcare, you're kind of building those kind of foundational elements and talking about it from a longer term point of view. Yeah. I feel like still keeping that bigger goal in mind.
Yeah. I feel like when you look across that industry, the type of products that have that strict regulatory and engineering component that drives, you know, the generational changes, you can see when one of them had, either like an engineering or kind of technology advancement that allowed, you know, design to come back to the table and do something that was a change. Mm-hmm. Then you can see when design had created a real step change and like reassessed the formula of how they build that product, of the experience of that product. And that's what we saw when we, you know, were invited in. We were really fortunate to work with your team for a few years and really digest the space and, you know, push that design mentality, design thinking, and start to break down those old barriers that are kind of assumed components of the next round of development and start to look at it fresh. It was a lot of fun and it really kind of lets you see how these markets are seeing a change. And, you know, as I think the commerce and the healthcare system are changing through the years, there is a new eye on design being a kind of competitive edge for either landing big accounts or being something that could go direct to consumer. And you start to see the competition you can see in like footwear and, you know, in consumer electronics, a lot of parallels need to start living here. And that's the new playing field we saw.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right about it, sort of those kind of big changes, you know, that was something that was desperately needed. You know, when I joined that team, you can't help but like probe, why is it this way? Why is it that way? And like, peeling back the layers, and it's very kind of weak excuses sometimes. It's like, oh, some random person that doesn't work here anymore made that decision. And we just don't want to challenge it. And I was like, yeah, I get that, but like, we're going to have to challenge it and pull off that band-aid at some point. And you know, I think the trick there isn't to try and do everything, but setting that roadmap, showing a way to say you need to kind of have those major moments, right? But then leave a little bit of a space for people to kind of make those kind of smaller refinements, but then, you know, be honest and say, we're going to have another major moment at this point here. And you can either wait until that moment or we can kind of set ourselves up for success right yeah. now as well. So yeah. I think it's, you know, talking about it in those terms. And then also, you know, honestly, just getting the right folks in the room, right? You know, there's some people, they just weren't into that. They're just like, no, not doing it. I'm retiring in 5 years. You know, I won't care about this, right? And it's like, fine. But you kind of talk to someone like, yeah, I fully get it. I'm an advocate for it. Kind of as well. And I think it just takes time to get that right team of, you know, similar mindsets and just taking on big, big challenges. Because, yeah, I mean, it's, you're asking someone to take on a ton of risk.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's fun.
And believe in something that may take, you know, 8 years to get through regulations and, trust that it's going to hit the market right. You place your bet on the right horse versus your competition. And you got to ride that thing out and stick with
it
till the end.
And nobody knows the answer. It's like,
I believe.
You know, and I think that was something, you know, we talked about quite a bit internally, I think before you guys joined, but like, me and Lloyd were kind of looking at this. How do you look at a future state, right? Not just from throwing stuff up against the wall, but trying to make considered bets. It's a bet, but like, you know, these are, you know, strong anchor points. You know, we talked about bigger themes like sustainability, for example. That's never going to go away, right? That's always going to be an anchor point. Whereas, I don't know, there are flashy things like I think of an example here, but some things could just be like a fad. Like that mightn't be there in a year or 2 years' time. So how do you ground it in some of those bigger kind of ideas that are kind of there everlasting as well?
Yeah.
And that's kind of fun.
Yeah, I think that's that type of product that has that many constraints to it. Sustainability is like, you know, as a designer, something you want to inject into everything. You know, in footwear, you know, a sustainable material might move some units and sell some shoes, but over here, it's not going to, you know, move the needle. But if you bake in sustainable practices and sustainable systems into like the strategy of how you're going to develop that product, you can really make some impact and, you know, drive some change. And, you know, when it pops out the other end and, you know, multiple years time, you may have gone further than your competition has. And that may be, you know, added up to be an edge in storytelling for the market.
In my just to wrap a bow on this, I think in our experience and for the audience, in case you hadn't picked up by now, but Oshin and Lloyd and co graciously picked up the phone and called Play & Co one sunny morning in 2019, 2020. I can't remember what year it was. It was around COVID, so it was all a blur. And asked us to collaborate with them on future concepts, and without going too much in proprietary subject matter, I think the magic that we all felt at the time was this, was that picking up on everything you said, Oshin, it was one part envisioning and thinking about the future. So to your point about future states, one of the first things we did when we got there was that utopian experience flow, right? So you've had like, this is the way the experience is today. And we're like, well, what would be this golden, what would be the ideal? Even though we know it can't be done, like, let's fly everyone to Ojai for a weekend to get tested for sleep apnea. But then from that, we started to romanticize a bit. Well, maybe we can do something with those ghetto sleep labs in the middle of town, you know, make them a little bit more desirable. And so there was one part envisioning, but then I think what else was, well, obviously with you guys, there was a huge amount of respect between the team, the designers and the creatives, but also the team that you guys pulled in. I think Lloyd was a fantastic conduit.
Liaison, yeah.
Liaison within the company. So he'd pull in people from marketing, from sustainability in Eindhoven, from engineering into these working sessions that we had. And people, to your point, people would be really prickly in the first couple of working sessions. But then over three or four, they'd start to use the words we used and plant the seeds we planted. Yeah. And then they would say, oh, I had a meeting with this giant retailer over here, and they're saying the same thing that you guys are saying in design, and we need to get on top of this because it's coming down the pike, whether the company likes it or not. And so I think, to your point, what I got energized about was that it was less about forcing a solution down someone's throat, like in consumer electronics, where you have to flip something around in 12 or 18 months. Yeah. And it was more like bringing people along for the journey and then creating a bit of a momentum, and starting from design and then and broadening out to marketing, engineering, and other aspects of the business. And then you just generating awareness. And you guys did that really well. So
yeah,
hats off. It's just unfortunate there were other things happening out of your control, which we won't go into. We don't need to belabor.
I don't know if I ever told you this, but you guys were earmarked for, well, when we first talked, we actually talked about a different project.
Oh, did you?
I don't know if you remember that, but yeah, the originally when we kind of connected, it was about something else, something a bit more near term. But as you know, we spoke, as you guys showed us what you're capable of, I was like, oh, okay, well, I have this other project here that I've been cooking in the background that no one's seen. That was kind of exciting. I think it was just the attitude you ultimately brought to the table. And I think that's where I kind of got excited. Like, oh, okay, actually these guys would be a better fit for something else. And I do think that was the case. Yeah, you guys wouldn't have liked that other project at all. Challenging.
Thank you, Ocean.
Yeah. We had to crush that too, but we appreciate it.
We're forever in your debt. Yeah, so that was Phillips. And good times.
We started off the conversation around a bit of like how we land this back at where you are now with in a probable future. And it just kind of struck me like a lot of what we employed through that, like, you know, two and a half, three years engagement with you guys is, you know, bringing other kind of business units or groups within the company or within your business unit, other components of that, sales, marketing, engineering. Yeah. And, you know, this difference or thing we believe in is, you know, like a sketch is a conversation and a rendering is a statement. And I think it's really it's interesting to kind of throw that onto what you're up to now. You know, AI has been used so much in like sketching and like creating, you know, half concepts, whereas I think you're really sitting on that side of like making, you know, kind of really clearly thought out, you know, curated statements that you can kind of marinate on. And I think that was like where we had to juggle that, like bringing people along for the ride, sketch with them, create the conversation, create that momentum. But then also, you know, when we got to that render stage of like presenting the thing out, we had everybody believing in the components that created that. So I think it'd be really interesting just to like hear how, like about your process. Cause I know when you came when we were working together, I loved how you asked questions and how you kind of broke down, you know, all the different conversations that were happening and got to the root of concept and what is the theme? What is the concept? What is the strategy here? And it kind of helped us kind of pull things with your team to a kind of a consistent way of creating output. I'd love to hear just kind of if that's still kind of the way you approach things.
It's kind of the absolutely the opposite of that.
Nice.
Don't ask questions. Before
I get into that, I wrote this down. I love this kind of way you phrase that, statements you can marinate on. And I think that's kind of the core of what I try to do with this, where it's like, these aren't end results, right? They're not like finished products. They're just conversation pieces. They're like thought starters to something else. And I think that's the key differentiator here. And I think a lot of people look at AI and view it as they compare it to something else, right? It's like, oh, I can't do this. Can't do renderings, or you can't make it. It's like, of course not, right? It's not meant to do that, right? This isn't, it's not trying to be a sketch, right? It's not trying to be a rendering. It's something that straddles a different set of space. And what it does is gives a different point of view that you've never seen before, right? I kind of equate it to mood boards, new imagery, but you've never seen this, right? Yeah. You know, you go into any mood board and it's like the same, this is the classic images, right? Guaranteed, you probably name, you know, five products that someone's got on the mood board, depending on what the theme is, right? But with AI, you're suddenly presenting something new, right? I mean, you think of the value of what a mood board is, what it does, it's trying to articulate something, right? It's not saying this is what it is. I'm trying to get a feeling, a vibe, something that doesn't exist, but here's a shorthand for me to do that alongside sketches, alongside talking about it. You know, here's, you know, I think that's where AI kind of plays that role, right? So think about when we work together, you have your Miro board and, you know, it's so much fun. We're just going to riff it. Like, oh, what about this? You remember this car, remember this, and you kind of pull those images in, right? And I think AI kind of serves that, you know, tool to visually represent those kind of ideas in a very kind of shorthand way. So you're not kind of losing that flow a little bit. You know, we're in the zone having a conversation. Oh, here's that image there. There's nothing worse than someone's like, oh, you know, there's this image I have in my head. I'm going to go off for like 10 minutes to Google it. It's like, oh, I never found it. Lose that moment. Whereas I think with AI, I'm not saying
guilty as charged.
You know what you're looking for to justify where you want to go, you know, with your efforts. Yeah.
It's kind of fun just kind of to spark. That's
interesting.
That, right. So I think back to your point, Jason, when it comes to, you know, how I use it, how I enjoy using it, it's, you know, less kind of constraints. Right. Yeah. I think that for me was the big appeal. Like, you know, coming from industries that are very, very constrained, right? You're designing products. It's like you got the rules in place. I think this is a way for me just to kind of get all that and have a bit more fun with it, but still have, you know, frameworks in place, right? Yeah. Do a few kind of principles to say this is what it must be here. But as far as the design intent, the ideas, that's pure just what if this, what if that? Yeah. It'd be cool if we did this. And just kind of throwing stuff together and seeing what happens. I mean, you guys are only getting a curated feed as well.
I
generate a lot of bad stuff. But I mean, I don't know, it's been incredibly exhilarating. I don't know if I've ever had a tool that can satisfy the itch so much, right? Where, you know, I used to kind of love Pinterest when it first came out. Dog shit these days, but when Pinterest first came out and you were only getting the content from the people you followed, you know, so you have this beautifully curated feed. It was just wonderful to get that very kind of clearly kind of curated content of some nice stuff, nice design stuff. So it's kind of a way to kind of feed that for myself, but then guide it. It's like, okay, I'm going to move away from this. So I want to go into these other spaces and see where I end up as well.
Yeah, it makes me want to give a big shout out to those Tumblr pages I still have bookmarked that I visit every once in a while. And some of those people are still curating. And you know what? Thank you, because you're still finding stuff that the machine is not feeding to me.
Yeah.
What about in terms of juxtaposition of traditional media and the thought process that is, you know, pencil or pen to paper and what goes through your head in that process versus, you know, prompt designing, prompt engineering. How have you noticed that it sort of changes your concept of exploration? Do you feel like it's just a tool and you would have arrived wherever you were going to get anyways? Or do you think that there's like a more poetic approach in traditional media that maybe would craft a more optimal solution than, you know, what the machine spits out?
Oh yeah. I mean, I still sketch every day. Right. So, and I think you know, sketching has its strengths in certain areas, right? And, you know, I kind of separate the two in much the same way. I'm going to sketch, then I go into CAD, I might render it, might sketch over that. You know, let's try to weave them all together a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's still a very early space. I don't really, you know, I think right now I have segmented some of the imagery from the traditional design process. But I do see a sort of space where they kind of overlap as well a little bit. But honestly, depends on the, you know, projects, where you're going for. But yeah, you just kind of, here's ways to mix and match certain things together. I mean, I don't know. I'll use whatever tools available, depending on, you know, what's you, the best way to articulate an idea. It's like, is it a sketch? Is it this? You're not so kind of exclusive and say, all right, I'm in my sketching moment now. And then I'm going to move on to the CAD phase. It's just kind of,
I think that's
going with the flow a little bit.
Sorry, Jason, I know you got your hand up, but I want to put a pin on that and say that's a really important lesson or point for young designers to consider, that you don't hedge your bet, you don't put all your stack all your chips on one tool. If you really want to be a designer who brings fresh ideas to the world, figure out what the tool can be used for. So whether it's AI, whether it's sketching, whether it's CAD, whether it's whatever, paint, watercolor paints, crayons, sketching in the dirt, chalk, whatever. Use the medium as an enabler, but your mind as the kind of the driver.
So that was the thing I was going to be curious to ask you, is if you, like, how much you still sketch, because we've been on 3-hour workshops together, and I know Oshin can throw down, he can sketch. And I think that may be part of why your curation of your images has been so successful. So as of right now, 239,000 followers on his account, An Improbable Future. And you can see a difference in your images than people who are doing a similar, you know, approach, or, you know, they're on a similar journey of exploration, but there's something that has connected with people and the way that you curate your images. And I think it is probably driven from the fact that you do have a handle on all the other parts of the creative process, and you are probably still, you know, engaging in them. And this is just a way to, you know, express something in your gut that you want to see created. For me, it's like the way I've looked at AI, I'd have like done a bunch of experiments with Stable Diffusion a while ago now, because I'm just back from paternity leave. But for me, it was about, like, when I pull inspiration, it's usually, I think that my filter is always trying to find fresh stuff that somehow went through a system and got made, and then still has beauty in some of those details. And those are the ones that the machine feeds you on Pinterest. But I also try to keep an eye on other industries so you can find something unique that combines. And I think that is kind of what you're talking about here, is like you have an idea of something you want to see, and you combine all these different elements, and it comes out fresh. And when it still has some beautiful kind of classic design kind of hiding in there, it really, you know, it's an image that you sit and stare at. So for me, like, I've always looked at AI from, I think, maybe the other side of things, is like, if I can just, you know, speed through a day of sketching and get to what I know I wanted to see, that still is a sketch to enable a conversation where there's lots of possibilities still, that's where I want to be. But it's very cool to hear that you look at this as that for you. It just is a higher resolution, kind of more quote unquote finished kind of visual, finished high resolution image. But you're looking at it in this, in a similar way, of that it's posing, you know, the next, what's next from here.
Exactly. You know, you brought that into a conversation, and I think it's so funny. You know, people, I get some comments, and they're like,
I bet you do.
You know, they're like, how does this sit in the bike, right? Or the wheels are off there, or this wouldn't work from a gravity standpoint. It's like, I don't care. You know, it's like, you're missing the point of it, right? The goal is to look at these things literally, right? It's about, talk about it from a feeling standpoint. Like, what do you get from an emotional perspective, and why? Like, what is that vibe you're kind of getting from it? Do you like it? Do you not like it? And I think just kind of having a conversation around that is important. Mm. In the same way, then, you have to use these, you'd have a mixture of sketches, a mixture of existing products. They're just kind of fillers to allow people to articulate an idea that doesn't exist, right? Yeah. Without it, then you're just kind of pointing to other ideas that do exist. And then you kind of end up in a space where it's the same products that we've always had over the last few years. And I think here's a way to maybe break that mold and come at something slightly different, because like I say, no one's seen this before. It's completely original in many ways, right? Okay, yes, it is built from existing products. One could argue that, but I mean, I think every design is built from existing products some fashion, right?
Yeah.
But I do think it's kind of needed, right, in today's world. I don't know about you guys, but I'm still kind of bored with consumer electronics. Maybe not lately, but, you know, if they think back to like the past 10 years, I think there's going to be just this same old stuff being churned out again and again and again.
Homogenization.
Absolutely. Like, and I think it's kind of a nice sort of chance to bring something new to the table.
Yeah, I wanted to elaborate on that a little bit because, to your point, all designers go to Pinterest. Or I shouldn't say all designers go to Pinterest, but the vast majority, it's a very popular tool, right? So you can see the expression coming back, whether it's a designer out of China, the US, Europe, or wherever. It's kind of like this global banality, should I say. I don't want to ruffle any feathers, but the point, I think, to your point about AI, what I am seeing, though, is new expressions through digital artists and they're not, I'm not talking about product designs, I'm talking about like Jason, we've been talking about robots recently and humanoid robots and new ideas for science fiction characters where everything kind of feels familiar, like the tricks, but all of a sudden everything feels fresh and new, like this very kind of the iridescent kind of glass head and just these just new ways in which materials, color, form, proportion are all being thrown together, but it doesn't feel like it's all off. It feels like the future. It feels fresh. Yeah. It feels like I can believe this is where the world's going. And that's back to you being a catalyst with an improbable future, plus a lot of digital artists right now creating these new expressions that are really nicely curated and feel fresh. I think it's exciting. I think what you're going to see, hopefully, what I hope to see is just new expressions, maybe more culturally appropriate, geographically appropriate, more maybe a sort of a return to kind of local design. We spoke a bit last year, I think, on a podcast or somewhere that, everyone was like, oh shit, the robot's going to take my job next year. And to a point where, well, there will always be a need for designers who understand how something gets made and machined and the value of materials and build quality. And there'll be rising of new niches, right? A guy who can start a watch brand out of, Melbourne or Thailand or Ridgefield, Washington.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm like over here on my other screen scrolling through your feed, and as a designer trying to solve problems with my constrained world, I'm like, I'm always looking at the simplest ones. I'm like, what is whittled down to here? What can I learn from this and maybe like apply that beautiful effect here and like find a way to make that happen on what I'm working on? There's one for the mood board. Yeah, it's really cool.
I think that, you really have the nail on the head there, Jason. Like, where does it kind of lead you? Where can you go? What does it spark? I think that's where it gets super exciting. Because without it, like I say, you're just looking at the same old stuff that you've seen before. It's like, oh, this thing again. And, I think when it comes to those kind of moments of design trends, right? That's what they are. You just like those trends. You remember the speckled plastic that was meant to be recycled, that had its moment and then, very quickly. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, just people go through these kind of cycles. And I think here's a way to inject something very new into it that isn't reflective of a trend, but really kind of puts you as a designer into the spot of like, what do you get out of it? Not, what trend do you see, but where does this kind of lead you in a different sort of space as well? And I think that's Just very, very exciting.
Nice.
Question, do you kind of know off the top of your head, like the type of image, like is it simpler? Is it, you know, the automotive stuff? Is it, you know, more nostalgic, old school things that perform better? Or is this still just a feed of things that you're exploring and having fun with? And that's kind of the magic happening here.
Just exploring, having some fun with it. Right. This cool. is, you know, my just moment to enjoy. Mm. Yeah. Just having, cool. playing around cool. with it and not worrying at all about like what's popular or anything. It's just, yeah, here's things that I like, you know,
cool. and yeah.
if people like it, great. If they don't, that's fine. But
yeah,
you know, ultimately it's like, this is interesting. And I'll be honest, there's been a few things I've looked back and I'm like, oh, I'm not sure about that anymore. Right. One or two, I'm like, oh, maybe that's not as cool as I first thought it was. But I think in general, everything there is representative of how I feel, or certainly it represents how I felt at that moment when I kind of post the image.
Yeah. It's wild. Like, yes. You scroll over ones that have like just classically, you know, like classical proportions of like what a product that's on the market that is, you know, is a premium. It's like 22,000 likes, and then the one next to it's like yes. 1200. You know, it's really interesting to just to see how people digest these.
Yeah,
I mean, it's wild.
You know, certainly one thing I try and do with that as well is have a little bit of a flavor. Sometimes I flick between like products that are near focus. This could exist right now versus this is never going to exist.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, it's just kind of playing with some of those bandwidths. Again, depending on what mood I'm in, right. Where yeah. I want to move in the different directions. But at the same time, also it does, you know, it does represent how and where I want to push the software a little bit. Some are definitely tests. Like, oh, okay, can we do this with material? Can the software do this with some of the lighting and seeing what works and what doesn't work? Sorry, Brandon, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's not a question. It's more of a, I want to acknowledge what you said, just having fun with it and make sure that if you are a young designer listening to this podcast, I think this is a tremendous exercise in when people flip out about having to build their portfolio coming out of school, think about other things that you might want to do. Like, this is a perfect portfolio piece, just learning a tool like AI, putting it on Instagram, being diligent enough to post it every 2 or 3 days, create a collection. That's a point of view that you know, that companies and directors will look at and, you know, bring your personality out. So I think that's something that we see in your work, Ocean. We know all the great stuff you do behind closed doors. So this is kind of just a little teaser of what what you can do.
Yeah,
that's all I wanted to say.
I like that though, about bringing a point of view, right? For me, if I saw this in someone's portfolio, it's not so much about the AI tools, right? Strip that away. Like, what point of view are you still bringing with this?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of missing a lot of times with a lot of the AI design work. It's like this, you're kind of replicating existing process, right? This is the bit I don't get of, like, you know, VizCom, for example, is great, but I just don't understand the value of that because it's just making a sketch a little bit better, right? But it's not, you know, you're not bringing a slightly different point of view to it. Yeah, okay, you are with the sketch, but I think AI has the ability to amplify that point of view in a different way. And that's where it gets a little bit more exciting.
Yeah.
But you've just got to have that perspective before you can kind of go into it, not just like making stuff.
Et cetera.
Yeah.
It reminds me a bit of some of the lessons that you learn from, if you've read the Creative Act by Rick Rubin. You know, it's like, you don't feed the audience what you think the audience wants. Like, be creative. The act of being creative, you know, is what changes the boundaries here. And I think if you see this in a portfolio and you've, like, you know, you see a young student coming out of school who has a design portfolio, but also has done something with a tool like this and created a following, you know, with a strategy like this, you'd be like, damn, they've found something, they found an insight and tapped into it with real action, you know? And that's very cool to see. And we're at a very unique time. So we got to, like, keep an eye on how all these things are, you know, enabling the creative process, how it's causing noise you don't need on the ones that aren't doing it right, you know? And what to keep an eye on that'll feed you in your creative journey.
Yeah. Actually, on that point, I did see a student portfolio where they were using AI to design sneakers. And it kind of just landed on my LinkedIn. And I don't know, every once in a while, I'll click on one just sort of see. And they had a section on AI designs that amongst traditional sneaker design, then here's AI design sneakers. And the first image was ridiculous. It was like something silly, like a panda or something like this. But when you went into it, it was like, holy shit, this is absolutely incredible work. Just so much effort put into it. They're using Stable Diffusion, a real understanding of the tools, getting underneath the hood, and then kind of shaping that from a, this is my intent and how I'm using this, these AI kind of tools to kind of lead in that creativity. I was really blown away by it. To the point where I reached out to the person. It's like, listen, here's some tips. Get rid of your nonsense images and focus only on this because it's super nice. Elevate this to the top. You know, the way it was being told, it was kind of like this throwaway story. Of like, well, here's my traditional portfolio. And by the way, yeah, I'm looking at AI and here's this incredible work. I was like, flip that around. If you want to be a bit more kind of provocative and, you know, future facing, this is one to lead with and see where it kind of goes. So fingers crossed they get a job out of it or something. I was actually going to send it to you, Jason. I thought it was just super nice stuff. But yeah, I think I'm excited to sort of where that kind of goes in the future.
You just reminded me of a moment when I was interviewing for a job once and sharing my traditional portfolio, and I was showing some kind of behind the scenes work from Boeing when I worked under Brendan and Karen. And I kept telling them how much time it took to get it done or like how quickly we got to the end result. And it was like an impactful, you know, deliverable that caused like a good reaction and moved things forward. And the person interviewing me was like, why do you keep telling me how long it took you to do this? I was like, you run a business here, right? Like my process is quick and it's impactful. And like, and we ended up getting through that and got the job. But it was very curious. So it's really interesting to look at, you know, how AI can speed up the creative process and get to like an impactful result. If it causes new inspiration and gets you to something fresh, that's going to, you know, impact the business you're working for or impact the design project or the brief on that deliverable. Like that's super important to be able to pick out of a young designer's portfolio if they've got an edge that somebody else doesn't. An interesting thought you kind of got me to there. So Oshin, what advice would you give to a young designer, you know, as a certified expert who also has the full range of design skills backing them up?
My advice would be open-minded and absolutely pick up these new tools. I firmly believe we're at an inflection point when it comes to design. And I think, you know, you need to get ahead of that, right? Not to discard traditional tools by any means, right? You still got to sketch, you still got to know CAD, right? But these are new ways to open up your aperture to bring some fresh thinking to the table, right? Still need a point of view, still need to have an opinion, but I think kind of don't be too snobbish not to kind of take a look at these tools, right? I think be open to them and see where they kind of go in the future.
If you want to continue the conversation, share your thoughts, or suggest topics for future episodes, be sure to connect with us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at PlayNCo, or visit playnco.com. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and until next time, keep playing, keep designing, and keep pushing the boundaries of what's next. This is Play In Conversations, signing off.